It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, October 16. Greetings, I'm Phil Picardi. If you like having Minnesota's news on your schedule, go online to minnesotapublicradio.org and pay your dues for podcast news during our fall membership campaign. Today, how long can CPR be used to save someone's life? The sparring continues over Minnesota's Secretary of State. The battle over Southwest Light Rail is now on hold. Some farmers are happy with the harvest, others are not. And funny man Billy Crystal comes to town to talk Dixieland jazz. Governor Mark Dayton and other key officials put the brakes on the Southwest Light Rail proposal yesterday, postponing today's Met Council vote on a plan to dig shallow tunnels under a bike corridor in Minneapolis. Here's Laura Ewan.
The decision came out of a private meeting between Governor Dayton and several local, regional, and state officials. For months, the question of where to put existing freight trains that currently run through the Kenilworth corridor of Minneapolis has bedeviled the project. Opposition to freight has pitted Minneapolis against its neighbor, St. Louis Park. The freight question has also sent the project's price tag to soar to more than $1.5 billion. Dayton's chief of staff, Tina Smith, says the governor wants to make sure the public has confidence in the way the project is being planned, even if it means putting off some key decisions for now.
This is obviously a project that has generated lots of high emotions. I think that people care a lot about it, and it is really worth pausing to take a moment to make sure that all these issues get worked out before we try to push this through.
Over the next 2 or 3 months, project planners will try to answer looming questions about how the proposed tunnels would affect some of the most cherished lakes in Minneapolis. The delay will also give planners more time to examine whether the freight trains in Kenilworth could be diverted somewhere else, as many Minneapolis residents have called for. Mayor R.T. Ryback says the extra analysis could help him bring him on board with the project, even if the studies reach the same conclusion of keeping the freight in the park-like corridor.
If at the end of the day we can say we don't have any other option, this isn't going to harm the lake, then I'll help make this happen, because it's critically important.
But the delay likely means a new mayor will be in office by the time the question of freight is resolved, because Ryback is not seeking re-election. If the Met Council were to approve the tunnel plan Wednesday, it would likely have put the project on a rocky and unprecedented path. Many officials involved with the discussions have referred to it as a train wreck in the largest city in the state and where the Southwest LRT route begins. Minneapolis City Council members had threatened to deny what's known as municipal consent, approvals that the Met Council is seeking from all five cities touching the line. And without their consent, getting funding from the legislature would have been tricky. Minnesota House Speaker Paul Thiessen, a Minneapolis DFLer, says answering questions now will keep the project on track.
A number of people saw that the path that we are on may actually make it a longer process than a shorter process. And I think that's the ultimate concern here, is trying to make sure we get to a place where the project actually moves ahead in the most expeditious way.
But not everyone agrees. The Minneapolis and St. Paul Chambers of Commerce, which support the shallow tunnels, say the delay could imperil federal support for the project. The feds are expected to pay about half of the project's costs. Until today, Met Council Chairwoman Sue Haig had stressed the importance of sticking to a schedule. Haig now says that resolving the questions, quote, is in the best interest of the project and the community and will save us time in the long run. Hennepin County Commissioner Gail Dorfman says the delay will also allow for a closer look at previous freight rail studies.
And so I think we want to go back and look at those studies and say, what's different now? Why did those studies seem to suggest you could do a relocation and do it safely and economically? And now we're told something different. And so I think the public and I think the elected officials deserve an answer to that question.
The delay is a blow to St. Paul Park residents who have fiercely opposed any effort to divert Kenilworth's freight traffic through their neighborhoods. A recently debated reroute plan would have cost $200 million, taken out dozens of properties, and placed the trains on elevated berms near a couple of schools. One of the neighborhood groups, Safety in the Park, was planning to celebrate all of its hard work in defeating the reroute. That party is now on hold.
Laura Ewan for us there. A Twin Cities music teacher is facing criminal sexual conduct charges for allegedly touching a student inappropriately. Matt Sepik reports.
The father of a teenager told Eden Prairie police that Robert James Ladwig inappropriately touched the boy during private flute lessons at the family's home. The boy, who was 14 at the time of the alleged abuse, told authorities that Ladwig made similar sexual advances over a three-month period earlier this year. According to the criminal complaint, the boy's father says he saw his son and Ladwig sitting close together on a couch after a lesson. The father says the two quickly moved apart when they noticed him. 2 years ago, Ladwig pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct for kissing a young female student. Ladwig, who's 29, says on his website that he teaches more than a dozen instruments, including woodwinds, piano, and brass. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Wisconsin has opened its second regulated wolf hunting season. Minnesota's wolf hunt begins November the 9th. Here's Dan Crocker.
Both states authorized hunts last year after the gray wolf was removed from endangered species protection in the Great Lakes region. Wisconsin officials have authorized a harvest of 251 animals, about 30% of the wolf population in the state. That angers Melissa Smith, director of Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf, who spoke at a rally in Duluth Saturday.
So I think it's really important that we come together and just declare no sport hunting of wolves. It is time. And we are going to lose them.
Minnesota is taking a more conservative approach to its second hunt. The state has cut the number of wolves that can be killed this year to 220, down from a quota of 400 last year. A recent survey shows the state's wolf population has declined by 24% since 2008. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
DFL Secretary of State Mark Ritchie will not be seeking re-election next year, but that has not slowed the Republican criticism that has dogged him through two terms. The latest dust-up is over Ritchie's launch of a new online voter registration system. Despite regular partisan feuding over election issues, Republicans have yet to field any Secretary of State candidates for 2014. Tim Pugmire has our report.
Republican State Representative Joyce Pepin of Rogers said this week that she will seek re-election to her House seat rather than run for Secretary of State. She was among those mentioned in recent months as potential GOP candidates. But so far, there is no Republican in the race.
I certainly care about the office and the work that it does and how important it is.
Republican Senator Mary Kiffmeyer of Big Lake said she's considering another run for the job she once held. Kiffmeyer lost her bid for a third term as Secretary of State to Ritchie in 2006. She said it's still too early for candidates to enter the race, and her decision won't come until the end of the year. In the meantime, Kiffmeyer is among the Republican lawmakers pounding Ritchie for developing an online voter registration system without first getting legislative approval.
Doing anything online has a risk with it, and especially something like this. And I just want to be sure. My concerns are it hasn't gone through the legislative process. It has not been vetted by our state IT departments nor the expertise that we have. And so it's been done on a unilateral basis.
Kiffmeyer and other Republicans want the Senate Subcommittee on Elections to hold a hearing to address their concerns. The panel's chair, DFL Senator Katie Sieben of Newport, said she will hold a hearing, but not until the 2014 session begins in February. Sieben said passing enabling legislation would help preserve the new online system, but she made it clear that she doesn't share the GOP concerns about Ritchie.
I think Secretary Ritchie is an ethical, consistently thoughtful Secretary of State who's looking to protect the integrity of Minnesota elections, and I don't have any concerns about his role as the Secretary of State. I think he's doing a great job.
Republicans have complained about Ritchie before, including his handling of two statewide recounts that their candidates lost. Ritchie presided over the 2008 U.S. Senate race recount that gave a narrow win to Democrat Al Franken over incumbent Republican Norm Coleman. Then there was the recount in the 2010 governor's race between Democrat Mark Dayton and Republican Tom Emmer. In 2007, the fight was over Ritchie's use of a state government mailing list for political purposes. GOP legislators took Ritchie to court in 2012 after he reworded their original ballot titles for two proposed constitutional amendments. They also accused him of wrongly campaigning against the voter ID amendment. GOP Senate Minority Leader David Hahn of Eden Prairie said there's been a clear pattern of behavior.
It seems that the Democrats have this idea that they should do things that they think are good, regardless of whether they have authority under law to do it, and see if anybody pushes back. Well, that's just not how we should govern this state. We should look to the law that the legislature has passed and try to be faithful to that.
Ritchie was not available for comment, but during an interview earlier this year, he downplayed his run-ins with Republicans as part of the job.
Any elected job comes with a lot of public scrutiny, and there are partisan activities that go on as part of our whole democratic process.
Not surprisingly, Minnesota DFL Party Chair Ken Martin also offered a vigorous defense of Ritchie. He said he believes the recent complaining shows a pattern of behavior by Republicans, not the Secretary of State.
Once again, the Republicans prove that the only thing they're interested in is standing in the way of anything that would allow more people in this state the opportunity to vote and to be registered to vote.
Martin said he's confident his party will hold on to the office next November. There are currently two DFL candidates in the race.
Tim Pugmire on the NPR News Update. A warm fall has helped Minnesota's $9.5 billion corn and soybean crops. But as the prospects for a big harvest grow, grain prices fall. And as Mark Stile reports, grain farmers may be facing a financial squeeze for the first time in years.
Driving his combine through a field of corn on his farm near Tyler in southwest Minnesota, Alan Roloffs watches the machine gobble up hundreds of corn plants a minute.
For the most part, this is really a nice field of corn here.
Occasionally, Roloffs glances at a computer screen mounted in the corner of the cab. One number on the screen is especially noteworthy. It says this field should yield about 200 bushels an acre. That's more than 20% above the expected statewide average.
I would say it's about the best this field has done. So I'm really pretty impressed with this.
Roloffs expects that when he tallies up the harvest from all his separate cornfields, together they'll average about 180 bushels an acre. That's still well above the state average. His soybean fields also look like they'll deliver more bushels per acre than in most years.
I think beans would probably average 53 or 54.
That would be about a third more than the state average, according to the latest forecast. Roloff says although it was an up-and-down weather year, heavy spring rains turned out to be more of a plus than originally thought. University of Minnesota Extension soybean agronomist Seth Nave says it's starting to look like the pounding rains of spring built up enough soil moisture to support the crop through the late summer drought.
This year is one of those years where I expected soybeans to really suffer because the drought was so prolonged.
But Nave says he believes Minnesota's final soybean yield will end up being better than originally estimated. Last month, the U.S. Agriculture Department predicted a statewide average of 39 bushels an acre. Nave says he wouldn't be surprised if the final figure is several bushels above that.
The fact that we're hearing soybean yields, 40, 50, 60, 70 bushel yields in some cases, pretty impressed that the plant could do what it seems to have done this year.
The bountiful harvest is causing grain prices to drop. Corn is 40% below last year's drought-induced peak. Soybean prices have held up better than corn, but have been falling over the past month. For livestock producers, the trends are a welcome relief after some tough years. They buy a lot of grain to feed their animals, and the falling prices will reduce their costs and boost profits. But for grain farmers, slipping prices will shrink profit margins.
The margins are going to get very tight.
MinStar Bank farm management analyst Kent Tesey says right now it costs more to grow corn than it'll fetch when it's sold. Soybeans are still profitable, but that may not last. But no one's sounding the alarm yet. Many farmers sold part of their crop on the futures market earlier this year at a profitable price. A good number of farmers carry insurance that pays off when grain prices tumble. TC also says the big farm profits of recent years provide a financial cushion to help get farmers through the downturn.
I think the biggest concern might be heading into the next year.
That's because farmers are expected to haul in another bumper crop in 2014. If that happens, grain supplies will grow and prices will fall. That could set off a more pronounced farm financial squeeze than farmers are feeling right now.
Mark Stile there near Tyler, Minnesota. Imagine performing CPR on a potentially dying victim for about 2 hours and 45 minutes. That's the total length of time that Tim Franco received CPR when he had a heart attack at a St. Paul job site in August. Franco's case is thought to be the world's longest example of extended CPR that successfully revived a patient with no heartbeat. But it's not the only recent case in Minnesota of a really long resuscitation, and these cases are happening more often, in part thanks to advances in CPR technology. But there's also been a change in attitude among some physicians about a patient's chances of surviving a prolonged cardiac arrest. Lorna Benson reports.
Come on, dogs.
Tim Franco has resumed his regular walks with his dogs Murphy and Maddie near his New Richmond, Wisconsin home.
Not enough. Murph, let's go.
The 56-year-old maintenance mechanic is still recuperating from his heart attack 2 months ago, but his recovery, by any measure, is stunning. Aside from some anemia and weakness and sore muscles from the thousands of chest compressions that saved his life, Franco appears fine, yet he came so close to death. He recalls the hot August day that he collapsed in his boss's arms. He had cleared brush in 90-degree heat and was trying to cool off in front of a shop fan at the end of his shift.
And my stomach was bothering me. My chest wasn't bothering me, but my stomach was a little bit upset.
Since then, he's heard all about his extraordinary rescue, from the bystanders who within a minute were giving him CPR, to the paramedics who a few minutes later strapped a portable CPR machine on him so he could be moved to an ambulance, to the emergency medical team at Regents Hospital in St. Paul who kept trying to save him long after others might have called it quits.
Well, I'm real happy that they didn't give up because I'm here to talk about it.
A self-described tough old guy, Franco's response to his ordeal is characteristically understated. But the emotion of that day is still raw for his wife, Ellen.
I didn't think he was going to come back. And in the ER, I kept telling him, you got to fight, you're strong, you got to fight.
Ellen Franco wasn't the only person who thought Tim wasn't going to make it.
It is an amazing survivalist story.
Johannes Brechten is the interventional cardiologist who was on duty at Regents Hospital that day. He removed the blood clot that was clogging a major artery in Franco's heart. It was a remarkable feat, considering that just a few years ago, Franco wouldn't have even made it to the hospital for treatment, because paramedics couldn't restore his heartbeat in the field. With basic CPR, it's not safe to transport patients, because rescuers can't use seatbelts if they're applying chest compressions with their hands. In Franco's case, paramedics were able to rely on an automated CPR unit called the Lucas II chest compression system. The device kept Franco's blood circulating, delivering much-needed oxygen to his organs. That gave emergency workers the time they needed to transport him to the hospital. And once at the hospital, the device kept pumping away while doctors tried to revive Franco and while they cleared his blocked artery.
The device worked so well that he was able to even interact and blink his eyes initially, keeping a blood pressure going.
That's because the device not only compresses the chest, it also lifts it up when the device retracts. That increases a patient's blood pressure and helps their tissues work better. So while Tim Franco's rescuers were working on him, he was able to answer some of their questions by blinking. That was an important early sign that his brain was still working. The Lucas device became available in the metro area about 4 years ago, and since then it's been adopted widely by Twin Cities EMS systems.
All you do is you turn on the machine.
Dr. R.J. Frasconi is medical director of emergency medical services at Regents Hospital. He says automated CPR is transforming the work of emergency responders so much that old CPR rules don't mean much anymore.
It used to be patient gets 15 minutes of CPR or 30 minutes of CPR, no shot, you might as well call it. With this device, that's clearly not been the case. We have patients with very extended periods of CPR.
Basic CPR still saves lives, and studies show that it can be as effective as automated CPR in many cases. But in a prolonged resuscitation, Frasconi says the Lucas device is taking rescue medicine beyond what anyone thought was possible.
When do we stop? We don't know when to stop anymore, because this machine does such a wonderful job.
And the extreme rescues are increasing. Stephen Fremmel is another recent example. The Lucas device kept the 62-year-old Alexandria man alive for more than an hour after he went into cardiac arrest on August 11th.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
doing better.
Yeah, looked really good.
Fremmel recently visited the cardiac team that saved his life at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. His cardiologist, Uma Valetti, showed him the automated CPR device that kept him alive while Valetti repaired one of his failing heart vessels.
And your heart was on arrest for about, I would say, 70 minutes or 80 minutes without a heartbeat. And we couldn't shock you out of it.
The soft-spoken Fremmel says he can hardly believe he survived.
No, I think that they could have just called it, you know. I think about that. How can you not?
Dr. Valetti remembers having some doubts about whether he was doing the right thing in trying to save Fremmel. He says there was a lot of tension in the cardiac catheterization lab that day.
We frankly had very senior faculty that felt the patient was dead and that it would be futile to continue the work. And I can't put my finger on one reason why the team continued to pursue it, but I think it was a collective sense that we had to keep going.
In this case, Valetti succeeded, and his patient is doing fine. But he says there was a real risk that he would fix Fremmel's heart and discover later that his patient's brain was irreparably damaged, and Fremmel would have to be cared for in a nursing home. There are some ways that doctors can get a sense of how a patient's brain is coping with extended CPR, but there are no perfect tests during emergency situations, and research on the subject is thin and based only on a handful of cases.
The whole business of resuscitation, I wish people who are doing it would report it.
Mayo Clinic physician Roger White is medical director of the defibrillation program at the Rochester Police Department. 2 years ago, he presided over a 96-minute resuscitation in Goodhue that used only manual CPR. Nearly two dozen volunteer responders took turns administering the CPR to a man who'd collapsed on a sidewalk on a cold January night. At the time, it was the longest successful case of standard CPR, and may still be. White says he's heard anecdotally about similar cases, but if the details aren't published, doctors can't learn much from them.
I suspect there are long resuscitations going on and we don't know about it. And even if the outcomes aren't good, for heaven's sake, tell us. You know, maybe there are other ways we can do this.
The cases of Stephen Fremmel and Tim Franco will be published in a medical journal. They will be included in a case series report that so far includes about 20 extended resuscitations that have occurred in Minnesota during the past 2 years. The cases are all resuscitations that lasted longer than an hour. Dr. Demetrius Yiannopoulos, medical director of the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium, is writing the report on all of the cases. Yiannopoulos says he's still gathering the data, but he says it appears that more than half of the patients survived with their brain functions intact.
And you would say, is it worth all this for just 10, 11 people? I would say if it's my father and if it's your dearest friend, probably yes.
Yiannopoulos says he has visited every cardiac catheterization lab in the Twin Cities to encourage doctors to be more aggressive in trying to save cardiac arrest patients who may have a treatable problem, like a blood clot or a damaged vessel. He says it's now standard practice in the Twin Cities to get these patients into the cath lab within 2 hours of their arrest. But not all physicians are comfortable with the uncertainty of these cases. There's still a lot of debate over how to best use new CPR technology, especially when it isn't clear which patients will benefit from it and which ones may end up suffering more.
That's Lorna Benson. Comedian and actor Billy Crystal is bringing his Tony Award-winning one-man show to Minneapolis. 700 Sundays will play at the State Theater next week. In the show, Crystal tells funny and often poignant stories about growing up just outside of New York City in the 1950s and 60s. One subject that gets a lot of attention is Dixieland jazz. Crystal's family was an important player in the New York jazz scene, and he grew up immersed in that world. Morning Edition producer Jim Bickle talked to Billy Crystal about his one-man show and his family's connection with jazz.
We had a little record store on 42nd Street. It was only 9 feet wide. It was a little hole in the wall called the Commodore Music Shop. And it was owned by my grandfather. And one of his sons, Milt Gabler, was a young high school kid who just fell in love with Dixieland jazz. And so much so that over time he said to his father, I want to produce my own records. I want to make my own records, which he started doing. And they became really well thought of and became, over time, collector's items. All the great Dixieland stars, Wild Bill Davison and Cutty Cutchill and Buster Bailey and Sidney Bechet and Ben Webster. It goes on and on and on and on. So my dad became the manager of the store, and my dad started producing jazz concerts with incredible jazz artists, and that's what I would be around. That was the Friday and Saturday nights. If you wanted to see him, you had to go into New York City and hang out at this big hall where he did these amazing jam sessions. And that's where I started listening to music as of an 8-year-old.
Yes, this is Dr. Jazz, the man who takes you round the town for the best in jazz right from the local dispensaries. Today, it's Jazz at the Plaza, coming to you from the Saul Bern Central Plaza building, 2nd Avenue between 6th and 7th Streets in New York City.
And that's the music I was around. And it also informed my comedy. Because they were hilarious, these guys. Their repartee with each other was so spirited and cool and hip. And it had a rhythm to it. The music had a joy to it. And it was intoxicating to be around them.
And they had a nickname for you, I understand?
My nickname was Face. Because I could imitate them. I could make their faces.
And you said that Willie the Lion Smith was your favorite among those. Why was
Willie,
that?
Willie was an amazing guy. He was a stride piano player, a fantastic character, and he was one of the few African-American Jews I've ever met in my life. And he spoke fluent Yiddish. I don't speak any Yiddish. I speak what I call Sid Caesar Yiddish. And he would call up the house, and I always answered the phone. Because I thought somebody was going to, you know, take me to Hollywood. And and I'd go, hello, and I'd hear this, hey, Face, Miss Moxter, what's happening? Where's the old man? I want to talk to him. And he'd be so hilarious on the phone. And he also was a great player, and I loved hanging out with him.
Yeah, what was his significance as a jazz musician?
Willie was that big left hand on the piano, and he had unusual rhythms that he would play. All different kinds of time signatures. And he was a dynamic guy. He was also a very cool singer, like a free-form kind of singer. And he was he's just an amazing character.
No one to walk with, folks. I'm usually all by myself. No one to talk with. I'm happy that I'm on the shelf. Folks, I ain't misbehaving. Cause I'm saving all my love for you.
Well, another story you talk about is Billie Holiday recording Strange Fruit. And she was not signed to the family's label there, Commodore. But she
at the time, no, she was at Columbia at the time. And nobody wanted to record Strange Fruit because it was a very ugly lyric to some people because it described the lynching of black people down south. And it was a very difficult song to listen to, and John Hammond, who was the genius producer and head of the company, said, I won't produce this. I need something that people can dance to. So she went back to my uncle, to Milt, who was one of her first producers, and together they record Strange Fruit. It's almost 75 years ago, and the master recording is in the Smithsonian. And the thing I'm most proud of is that it's my uncle and my family. Everyone stood up together as a white Jewish family to say we're making Strange Fruit. So that's a very proud feeling.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
That is Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, a song produced by Billy Crystal's uncle Milt Gabler. The story of that song is one of the tales that Billy Crystal tells in his one-man show, 700 Sundays, which will play at the State Theater in Minneapolis next week. That's all for the Wednesday edition of the NPR News Update podcast. I'll see you tomorrow with Thursday news.
Pastoral scene of the gallant sound. Bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell.